Welcome to the Antimatter Radio Show, the second edition of this show. I'm very pleased that all of you are choosing to listen to this show. This is a show where we attempt to overcome any sort of limitation due to the cultural systems of the world, which limit people's thoughts and ability to understand things, unfortunately. That was, I don't think, always the case. If you look back at our history and our ancestors, I think there were times where we were not limited to what we knew and to what our ways of knowledge were presented through culture. I want to read you a quote before we get started here. Actually, I have to go over the quote in my memory here because I forgot to grab the book that it comes out of before the show started. I've been reading a book called Lost Star by Walter Cruttenden, and it's proving to be one of the better books that I've read in some time. It's about the cycles of the ages through time. If you notice, we're supposed to believe, the academics want us to believe, that we're on a path of a linear path, we humans are through time, where we started off as monkeys and then got more and more advanced and then we came to the point where we are now. But it's just amazing that the academics want us to believe this, because there's simply no evidence for it, and all the evidence that even they are themselves presenting to us show the opposite theory. I mean, they've discovered skulls from human-like creatures, like such as Cro-Magnon, is the name of one skull. Cro-Magnon Man, it's often called. This fellow, I think, lived 30,000 years ago or so. He had a significantly larger brain than we do as humans. So there, right there, boom. The idea of a linear progression of humans becoming more advanced from monkeys to now without any, huge significant oscillations on that path is gone, done. Also, the Dark Ages disprove that theory. No, it's just a theory, not evidential claim or something. The Dark Ages were, the Egyptians were clearly significantly more advanced than the Greeks or the Romans also, and probably even us. We don't even know how to build those pyramids. And those aren't even the most amazing pyramids or structures there are. In Lebanon, there's a structure called Baalbek, which I may have mentioned in last week's show. 1,200 tons this rock weighs, perfectly cut, carved, put in place, without any settling through the centuries, to any cracks, nothing. We don't know how to do that today. Our machines can't lift or cut nor lift and put into place rocks that are 1,200 tons. Ours can lift things that are about 200 tons, maybe. But the rocks at Baalbek in Lebanon were carried for apparently hundreds of miles. So anyways, this book that I'm reading by Walter Cruttenden is just truly extraordinary. I recommend all of you take a look at it. You can also listen on YouTube. He was on Coast to Coast AM. You can listen to some of his interesting material. But he, in his book, he has a quote from Max Planck, one of the most famous physicists in history. And Max Planck says, now I'd never seen this quote before. It shocked me when I read it. I know how impressive these early physicists were, the early quantum physicists like Bohr and Heisenberg and Planck and so forth, David Bohm. But Max Planck apparently said, in getting his Nobel Prize at his speech when he was receiving his Nobel Prize in Physics, he said that matter does not exist, and all that exists are vibrations of energy controlled by an unseen intelligence. I believe that's exactly word for word the quote. And I can't remember what page. You'd have to go look in Cruttenden's book to find the page. I'm sure you can find the quote on the internet too. Now that's what we're interested in this show. But he said matter does not exist. That's why this show is called the Antimatter Radio Show. We don't have a devotion to the existence of matter. We're not slaves to matter. if we're adhering to the principles that this show teaches. Matter is something that if you study it long enough, if you get the microscopes out and the magnifying equipment and look into it, you know, just take a piece of matter like a pen or something and take chunks of it off and dissect them smaller and smaller and to see what it's made of, you eventually come to something that is no longer material. Which is fascinating. So that means that the pen, which appears to you, to your eyes, to be matter, is actually not matter. It's made of something else, a spiritual force, energy, something where people are trying to figure out exactly what it is. People in the world religions are trying to figure out what reality is made of, what this stuff, quote-unquote stuff, that makes up everything is. Is it God? Is it orgone energy, as Wilhelm Reich said? Is it the astral energies that the theosophists talk about, or are those all just different terms for a glimpse of the same ultimate reality? I would guess that our ancient ancestors, from reading Cruttendon's book, and I was aware of some of this previously from other works I've read and other writing I've done, Cruttendon's book really lays it out nicely, though, but I would guess that our ancient ancestors had the ability to very clearly see ultimate reality, unlike we do. Now it seems bizarre and impossible for us, but they clearly were more advanced than us, and we've got direct physical evidence that is simple and pure. That's the kind of empirical evidence you want, simple and pure evidence, something that's not controversial. If you have a structure like Baalbek in Lebanon, or all these pyramids all over the world, which are all aligned to the stars, the Orion Belt, and they're all aligned with each other, and built in architectural ways that we don't even understand now. We can't even figure out how to do it. Even if we dissect the pyramids, we can't reverse engineer it. Clearly, they were more advanced than us, so something was going on back then. Something with the energies of the world were different, and they influenced humans, our brains, and they spiritualized us, and we have lost that. We appeared to be at the lowest point of that, in the Dark Ages, and now we seem to be ascending upward again. Maybe we'll get to a golden age that we appeared to be in something like 10,000 or 20,000 years ago or something. So before we go on, one thing I wanted to talk about is evolution, and specifically human beings coming from chimpanzees. We got into that a little bit last week, and I remember saying there's two main lines of evidence that the professional academics present to tell us that we are evolved from chimpanzees, not any other animals, specifically chimpanzees. And we only covered one of them last week, and that was the fossil finds, all these bones all over the planet. There's actually only been just a small amount of finds, actually. I think only 50 or so. You know, some number like that. You know, it's not thousands or tens of thousands or something. But, so it's a very tiny scientific sample. So that's called a bad scientific sample. And when you do a lot of science, you want to be able to have lots of samples and so you can have lots of data and lots of, data to compare with other data so you can, refine things and get to the best theory. Okay, so that's a good scientific sample is the number of electrons that we've discovered. I mean, whenever physicists get their big particle accelerators out and try to find electrons, they always know what they're going to find. They always find the same thing. And every single time they do the experiment, they get predictable results. And they can do it any time they want, thousands of times over and over. That's a good scientific sample. Then science has given us knowledge of something. A bad scientific sample is when you have 40, 50, 60 bone finds where nobody in the scientific community can really agree at all on what they are, if they're baboon bones or human bones or how the human bones fit together, or, you know, are they 3 million years old, 3.5 million years old. There was I think it was in Malaysia, there was a famous anthropologist in the 1950s who found a bone, it would look like a femur of a pre-human or an ape or something, and then something like 50 yards away, he found a skull all smashed apart or something. I can't remember. It was not a complete skull. It was very controversial to say that it was a human skull. But anyway, the point is he, or a pre-human skull, sorry. There was the point is he made the specific effort to tell us all that, oh, those are from the same creature, 50 yards apart. So I was wondering, you know, did the creature get blown up or something? Did it explode? You know, why, how can I possibly make the assumption that if two bones are 50 yards apart, that they're from the same creature? You know, the same would apply, you know, with Lucy, which was found, I think it's something like 4 million years old, estimated, and it's Australopithecus is its scientific name. One of the early hominids, really, I mean, many, many, many professional scientists thought when it was found that it looked like a baboon. And it takes a lot of effort to say, no, it looks like a human, or a pre-human, sorry. And, you know, so all these bones are found together. Why do you assume that they're all from the same creature? I mean, if they've sat there for 4 million years, that's a lot of time for the earth to settle and compress and pack down. And I mean, we find so many other animals, like mammoths and so forth, all smashed together because of, you know, they all got carried away in water and they got smashed together in some area, you know, in a cave or against trees or whatnot. And then they all died together and then all their bones mashed together. I mean, how do we know these bones are all from the same? It's a huge, careless, reckless, wild assumption. And it just really makes the whole field unscientific. I mean, I would be the first one to line up and say, oh, sure, we came from chimpanzees or some other animal, we evolved creatures, if there was the evidence. But, I mean, we need evidence. The kind of evidence that, you know, oh, if I want to go find an electron, I can just go look in the particle accelerator with the physicist, and they'll show me an electron there on the computer screen. Okay, from what their particle accelerator produces, the measurements it produces. That's good science. That's, you know, that's totally different than this, the other, what I was talking about with the bones. But anyways, I could go on and on and on and on and on for the rest of the show, literally, and then into next week, about just all these problems with these bones. I actually have an undergrad degree in anthropology from the U of New Mexico, as I think I mentioned last week. So I'm quite familiar with all this. It's really fascinating material. It's just, the problem is all the assumptions are made. I mean, there's nothing, the science itself is quite remarkable. It's just when you throw in all these theories and assumptions, that's what makes it really sloppy, unfortunately. So anyway, let's get to the other piece of evidence that was, quote, evidence, unquote, I should say, that the professional academics give us that we have evolved from chimpanzees. And of course, all of you listening know that is DNA. They say that our DNA is such that we can prove that we are related to and evolved from chimpanzees. And there's two ways they do this. One is they say that there are certain similarities between chimpanzees, especially the bonobo chimpanzee, their DNA and our DNA. There's so many similarities, and we have not as many similarities with any other creature on Earth, so therefore we evolved from them. Okay, now, and all of you listening can hear the huge assumption built in there. I mean, it may be, you know, if we could have some more evidence, maybe we could see that it's true. But that on its own right there doesn't do it for us. I mean, so what if we happen to have, you know, some more scientific research and find out, dig into DNA a little more, discover what it's about, and find out, oh, no, we have a little more in common with dogs or something, a little more DNA, or maybe the big apes or something. So then we all of a sudden say, oh, no, we evolved from them. No, we're just, these are just, when you find two things that have similarities to each other more than they have with other things, that doesn't mean that one created the other. Okay, that's a wild, reckless assumption. Okay, but that's not really what I want to go over. That's actually the small problem for this idea that DNA shows that we evolved from chimpanzees. Let's get to the bigger problem, and it's quite remarkable how this all plays out. Here's how it goes. Let me just get right into it. We've been told since, oh, I think it's been the 70s and 60s that I just remember it ever since I was born in 1970, and I just remember it always being taught to me in schools. So it must have been around before then sometime or earlier. I don't know exactly when it started, but we've been taught that we share the most DNA material with chimpanzees, so therefore we came from them. Okay, now that's nifty, but here's the problem. When did we go and measure and map out and discover what all of the human DNA is like? And the answer to that is very simple, very obvious. That was in the year 2000. Okay, everybody remembers the Human Genome Project. I think it was a company named Celera Genomics, very wealthy, government-related mega company with it's a sort of suspicious company if you look into it more carefully. But anyways, there was all kinds of companies and university researchers trying to map out the human genome. And one day they came out and said, "We've mapped the human genome. Yay, finally we did it." And really it turned out that they only mapped about 20% of it or something, but well, who's looking at the particulars and the details? So the media had a bunch of fanfare, and it was a big celebration, and you know, it was a media circus for a while, and you know that they mapped the human genome. And the first thing I was thinking of, that's kind of interesting. If they mapped the human genome, that means that we had previously not mapped the human genome. So if we previously had not mapped the human genome, we could say, you know, to make it real, real simple, all the chromosomal structure of our DNA, the chromosomes where our DNA reside. So let's just keep it simple and not get into all that else so I can finish this thought. But anyways, if we had not previously mapped out our DNA, then how do we know what our DNA was structured like? And here's the ultimate question. If we didn't know what our DNA was structured like, how in the world could we have known that it was like, had similarities to chimpanzees? Answer, I think, is we couldn't. And we had certainly not mapped chimpanzee DNA out either. So if we had not mapped and measured and found the structure of human DNA and chimp DNA, how could we be sitting there for decades and decades saying we have more similarities with chimpanzee DNA than any other creature on Earth? And the answer is we couldn't. And the proof, absolute proof of what I'm saying is that we couldn't, and that was all just a lie or something when we were told that, you know, scientists knew what DNA was structured like and what chimpanzee DNA was structured like, and the two were so similar, more similar than any other creatures. They were more similar to chimpanzee DNA was more similar to human DNA than other creatures. The proof of that is because scientists discovered when they mapped the human genome that there's something that they rather absurdly called junk DNA. And they, but basically, long story short, what this means is they found out that, I can't remember the exact number, some huge percentage, 90% of our DNA or 95% of our DNA or something, nobody knows what it is. Nobody knows what it does. And it has literally almost every creature you could ever imagine, it's their DNA structure is found in that DNA. So in other words, let me restate this. Your DNA has what scientists call the active part of the genes that express to create the creature in your phenomenology, which is the structure of your body. Okay, so then there's those genes, and those allegedly, we were always told, had so many similarities between us and chimpanzees. Okay, and then there's the rest of the DNA, which we are told does not express, and I'm very, very doubtful about that. I'm looking into that more, and I want to see more evidence. We're told it's just there, and it's just there for no reason. It's just a vestigial relic of something else. You find every single, you even find creatures that we don't know what they are. It's almost like they're extraterrestrial or extinct creatures that went extinct long ago, according to the evolution theory. Because we're supposed to believe that the junk DNA is sort of a record of our evolutionary past. Okay, now there's a problem with that. And, well, I want to stay on one topic at a time here, but there are problems with saying that, which I'll try to get into later. So the issue here is that we're supposed to believe that the chimpanzee DNA and our DNA and the junk DNA also prove that one is the ancestor of the other. But I have an article here. It's Science Daily. The chimp genome reveals a retroviral invasion in primate evolution, April 5, 2005. If I'm not mistaken, this article appears to show that there are problems with correlating human DNA and Pansy DNA and the junk DNA segment. And if that's true, then we've got further problems. And that's one of the big things that professional scientists want us to believe is a reason that we can prove that we come from chimpanzees, because there's a record in each of us that shows our evolution, and we have the same record up to certain points. And it's only the case that they have a certain record and we have a certain record to prove that we came from them. Okay, that's the same problem is you know, those are actually just associations. But fine, let's just go with it. But it appears that may not be what some of the professional articles and some of the professional journals are reporting. They're reporting that there are asymmetries in these what are called retroviruses. That's what certain marks in the junk DNA are called. So there's I'm going to get on with this and get to another subject. But to end this and to sum it up, we're told that in our DNA and in the fossil record, we have scientific evidence to believe that humans have come from chimpanzees. Okay? But I've just told you last week and this week on this show, and I've given you scientific references from the academics' own journals that show I could go on to so much more. I'm just really going along fast here. There's enormous problems with that, and the problems are so great that we almost have to abandon the theory, if you think about it, back on everything I've talked about last week and this week. And in fact, there's no evidence to show, no evidence in the scientific sense specifically, to show that we come from chimpanzees. And in fact, if you start to, you know, it's kind of funny, I would want to find a scientist, an anthropologist, a biologist, who made it their profession not to look for evidence of human evolution from chimpanzees. But hey, well, why don't we find some scientists that try to find non-evidence? You know, how beneficial would that be? Why does every single scientist out there in the professional circles have to do the same thing? Only search for evidence, which is, as we have discussed, is not there. But why don't we find somebody looking for non-evidence? Because then all of a sudden you find some really productive studies, and the non-evidence is just absolutely everywhere. I think last week I talked about some of that, so I won't repeat all that, but one thing I talked about is the size of our brain. No scientist on planet Earth can describe why it's there and the huge size that it is compared to any other animal. Nobody has a clue. And that shows a huge, stark asymmetry between us and any other creatures, especially the chimps that we're supposedly evolved from. And there's a massive thorn in... that shows a discontinuity between us and primates. And that discontinuity is serious, especially when there's so few supposed bone finds and so forth to link us, which those are very questionable, the ones we even have. So let's get on to a new subject then. We can just clear our minds here now and wonder, what are we? Who do we come from? Who did something create us? What exactly is our human nature? What are we supposed to be here for? Why do we have such huge brains? What are they for? If we're not just butt-sniffing animals, because there's no evidence for that, as we've discussed, then what exactly are we? What's our purpose? Are we some sort of religious creature with an incredible purpose, maybe a godly purpose? Because if you look at the world religions, wow, they sure seem to not tell us that we're just a bunch of dumb animals that can do little more than bang each other over the head. Of course, there are wars in the religions, like with the Greek myths, the Old Testament, the Vedic traditions, and so forth. But the world religions, it's amazing. They certainly seem to tell us that we are, our destiny in life, what we are meant for, is to connect with the ultimate force of reality. That's what we are put here on Earth to do. It's what we are made to do. And life is complete when you do that. Now, the ultimate force in reality, you can take your pick, whatever you want to call it. You can call it God, life force, prana, nirvana, energy. It doesn't really matter because, as you know from the last show, I don't make huge differences between all of those. And as we said last in the last show, also that is called mysticism. But the point, that's when you have your consciousness has direct contact with the ultimate force of reality, whatever that is. And that's the goal of the world religions, to study, investigate, find techniques and different tools and meditations and techniques on how to contact this and to see and experience this ultimate force. Now, it seems that our ancestors were quite preoccupied with that, if you look at the world religions. Now, why do I want to look at the world religions to discover things about our ancestors rather than science to discover things about our ancestors? Well, the answer to that is utterly simple, because there isn't any evidence for anything. Science tells us that, oh, there's some buildings in, you know, India and Egypt that go back a little ways, and after that, we know nothing. We have some spears and rocks and stuff that people built 80,000 years ago, and that's about it, all the way back millions of years. So I have no choice. There's nothing science has to say about human origins past just maybe 2,300 years or so. So, of course, I'm going to look at the world. But on the other hand, we have this incredible wealth of information from the world religions, which all of which is totally consistent with each other. In other words, what you find in the ancient Aztec religions is totally consistent with Christianity. What you find in Christianity is totally consistent with Buddhism. What you find in Buddhism is totally consistent with, some shamanic religion in the Amazon rainforest or something. Just unbelievable, amazing that this is the case, and virtually everybody's ignoring it on planet Earth, and we think that the religions are meant here to make us all rise up against each other and fight. I just had a friend, I was in Los Angeles this week, and I had a friend that I was talking to. He was asking about my book, Telementation, that's coming out. And I told him that I was a Buddhist. He's a very strict, sort of old-fashioned Christian. I would say non-biblical Christian. And his first reaction was to fight against that. And, if you look in the Bible, I don't think that that's what Jesus is all about. Jesus is all about, helping prostitutes at wells and, helping, out criminals and giving partygoers more wine, creating it from water. That's an interesting story in itself right there. So, but anyways, if you look back at in the world of religions of who we are as people, it is starkly obvious and incredibly crystal clear that we humans are meant for absolute greatness, and the way we're living now is wrong. We've got everything backwards. I'm not saying we should abandon industry and things like that. I didn't say that, and I'm not implying that now. We can maybe make our industries enlightened, and we can maybe make them work with the human religious psyche. Keep in mind that I used the word religious, as I described last week, to be defined as mysticism, not as what probably most of you are thinking. So that is what we are destined for, in my, not just my opinion, but I think I can prove it, because everything about us is bent for religious experience. Our bodies are made for religious experience, our brains, our organs, our desires, our lusts, our personalities. Everything in us is made to seek out profundity and beauty, intimacy with others, to seek out the divine energy and light that is everywhere, that makes up everything, and which is written about in all the world religions. So what is to stop us here from thinking that that is exactly what we're made for? I mean, the science isn't telling us anything profound. I mean, we may hear on the Discovery Channel or something, oh, you come from chimpanzees, and then the mob of American citizens believes it, but there's no evidence for that, as we've discussed, so I'm not going to believe it. I only believe what there's evidence for. What is evidence? Well, there's two kinds. They both, however, have to do with what I can experience with my consciousness. If I can see right in front of me a pencil, which I'm holding in my hand, I have evidence that there's a pencil. Okay, and if anybody was here with me and saw there's a pencil, I mean, are we going to have a big debate? Is there a pencil here? Probably not. That's in the physical domain. Our eyes tell us what is real, and they don't lie. Now, that's in the physical domain. Somebody could say, ah, but you said early in the show, if we chop up that pencil small enough, we find out that there's nothing pencil-like there anymore. There's no more matter. The matter disappears. It turns into spiritual energy or something. Absolutely, but that's a different realm of reality, which requires a different kind of evidence. Okay? So there's two kinds of evidence. One of the physical realm. If you want to gather information about the physical realm, you use your senses. Okay? That's the basis of all science. And, of course, many of you recognize that a lot of scientists aren't doing that so much. Unfortunately, they're making up too many theories based on nothing, as we've discussed. Then the other kind of evidence is evidence of the other domain, which is the vast religious, mystical domain, which is everywhere and is much more powerful than this sort of pathetic physical domain, which doesn't really exist other than just in our ideas, which I'm going to talk about extensively here shortly. And so how do we gather evidence about the religious domain? Well, in a similar way we do about the physical domain, we just gather up our experiences about religious entities. So if you do Buddhist meditation long enough and meditate to a state of nirvana, you can take notes and make analytical investigations about what reality is like in that nirvanic state. And you would be therefore gathering evidence on what the domain, the realm of ultimate reality is like in the nirvanic state. That's pretty much about it. Now, you're not using your physical eyes when you're doing that kind of investigation. You're using, the theosophists will call it your astral eye, that's a term I really like, and I think Buddhists and theosophists are the same. There's no difference, but that's a whole other show. Maybe you can call it your third eye, or your pineal gland, which is an actual physical gland inside your head that looks like an eyeball, as we talked about last week. So, let me take a little bit of a break here at the exact halfway point of the show to tell you more about me. You can, my website is abstractadam.com. That's the word abstract, just A-B-S-T-R-A-C-T. And then Adam is A-T-O-M. And on that site, it's a site that's under construction, but you can find out everything you want about me at that site. And all my books, I've got one book that is published professionally by Progressive Press. That book is called Corporatism, and that's about, selling very well, I'm happy to say. I've been on a lot of radio shows to push that book, and I've had people like Alex Jones praise it very highly, and Dr. Bill Deagle has praised it very highly. Those are pretty big names. So there's some power to that book. Let me tell you what it's about very quickly, because I was just talking about this with my wife, and it just really gets me sort of fired up. The world is controlled by a secretive set of people who they're behind the scenes. They control all the governments of the world. Now, some of you may think that this is just a bunch of theory and how do we prove this? Well, it's so simple to prove this. It's unbelievable. All I need to do is say IMF, World Bank, WTO, that's the World Trade Organization, or the World Health Organization. These are non-nationalistic entities all working together, controlling all the governments of the world and not devoted to, created by any single government. There's many other organizations like this too. The CIA is roughly one. If those groups are not of a single government, but they control all the governments of the world, and you can see this with the swine flu, it's exactly what they're doing. Forcing all these different stipulations and so forth on country because of this swine flu, which killed, 20 people? Which, that's about how many people die of TB in about 5 minutes. There's other ways to prove that this group exists. So if you hear on Fox News, somebody says, oh, it's a conspiracy to say there's a secret world government, secret New World Order behind the scenes. They can laugh and play the little childish games, and you know, on a Cartoon Network called Fox News Channel. Fine, just ignore them, because I just proved it to you that they exist, and it took me, I think, under 10 seconds. It was absolutely simple to prove. So anyways, my book, Corporatism, is all about that. Everything you could ever possibly want to know about what this group does, how they operate, how they're affecting you, and it's very significant how they're affecting you. They control consciousness is what they do primarily more than anything. And the book is just, I'm just really happy with the book, and it's just, if you don't mind me saying, it's just wonderful. I just put my soul into that thing for 4 years when I wrote that. And I like to read it myself still these days. It's got 820 footnotes, and it's amazing. I can't believe that the world is like that. I mean, I was raised to not know that that was the case until I was about 30 years old. I'm now 38. And, you know, it still takes me a while to realize that that's how it is. So anyways, I've got some other books. Telementation is coming out. You can buy it now on my website. It's listed on the left-hand side of every page. You can buy it on lulu.com. It's just a place you can post things to publish for people to buy. But it's actually being published Tree of Life Publications. This pretty quick, I think it's coming out. I just got an email from the publisher saying it's coming out pretty quick. That book is about the law of attraction. Law of attraction is, roughly put, the theory, but actually you can prove this. If somebody would, any university would just put up the experiments and carry them out, it'd be pretty easy to prove and make it a very scientific. And if, you know, if that matters, we don't need to make everything scientific. I mean, some things are just known by people deep down. So anyway, it's the thesis that your innermost consciousness creates reality. Okay? So if you get in a car crash today, you willed it into existence. If you won a basket of seeds and organic fruits and vegetables and so forth, as I did on Sunday, and I was from the natural market around the corner from my house on a raffle contest, and I was so happy I did because I could give it to my wife for Mother's Day. I willed that into existence. Okay, if you, the people in Darfur who are suffering, willed their fate into existence, and I actually cover that late in my book, Telementation. If you are a millionaire, you willed that into existence. Everything is willed into existence. It's simple. It's a simple concept. It's what you've always been doing your whole life. And if you haven't known that you've been doing it, that's because you're not paying attention. You're not looking at your inner consciousness and the world to notice the correlations. You're just looking out at the world, so you never notice what your consciousness is doing and creating it all. Okay? That book, Telementation, teaches how to do the law of attraction. I think it teaches it in a better way than other books. I think a lot better than other books like The Secret. I'm not saying anything bad about The Secret. I love that book. I love so many of the books out there. And the law of attraction, they're just wonderful. Especially, I think it's, what are they called, Abraham Hicks, that group. They're just remarkable people. I mean, I love to go on YouTube and watch their videos. They fill me with utter happiness. So I'm not trying to, I just think the book Telementation has a different slant. That's all I want to say about that compared to the other books. But I think it teaches very easily and just wonderfully how to do Telementation. It's a simple, short instruction book. So, Telementation is the law of attraction. It's synonymous. So, anyway, there's all kinds of other things that you can look at on my website about me and my writings. I've got another book coming out this summer called The Telescreen, which is sort of a follow-up to the book Corporatism, which I just discussed. So the reason I talk about these books is because I want to sell them, of course. I'm not going to lie to you and say, I don't care. No, these books, you know, if any of you ever had a painting that you did and you worked on it for 4 years, and you put everything into it, and it was, when you saw it, you just felt it was the most absolutely beautiful thing you'd ever seen, you would want to share it with people. You would want to have other people feel the way you do, all these joyous feelings you got because of this wonderful painting you made. That's why I'm telling you about my books. Okay, so if you're not interested, don't buy them. If you are, buy them if you have the money. I think that they won't give you as much passion as they've given me. So anyways, this is the Antimatter Radio Show. And the website for the radio show is antimatterradio.com. And that we're going to build this radio show up. We're going to try to get it to be pretty big. Not because we want to be seeking fame, but because we want to spread the message of antimatter. Antimatter means against matter. We are not that when we see a flower and we say, oh, we don't like matter, so we want to destroy the flower. No, because we know that the flower ultimately is not pink, is not yellow, it does not have green leaves. The flower is pulsating, powerful energy that is directly impacting our consciousness. And energy doesn't have color. Energy has, well, you could say it has a religious, mystical color, but that's not physical color. Okay, so when you see a flower, if you see a pink and yellow and green flower, that's beautiful and wonderful, and I hope it fills you with happiness. But to truly see a flower, you're going to see a flower as being indistinguishable from the vibrational energy patterns everywhere in reality. And that's true happiness to get to that point. Now, are people like me at that state all the time? No, I usually in meditation I get there, and that there'll be afterglows. But some people, I just watched a video by Eckhart Tolle called The Flower in the Human Consciousness. Some people may reside in that level much more than I do, in this high meditative state where you see actual reality as being this energy field. Now, I got the feeling when I was watching that video that he may be there quite a bit. That's wonderful. And the video that he had was just absolutely wonderful. I was quite surprised how good it was. So anyway, the point is that if you have only experienced matter your whole life, you're going to feel a certain way. Okay, you're going to feel kind of empty. You're an egotistical person. In other words, the ego, what philosophers often call the ego, is what rules your life. It's the lowest form of the ego is what's called the lowest form of consciousness. And a higher state of consciousness is associated with seeing actual reality, which is, call it what you want again, the astral energy, nirvana, subatomic energy. There's many other names you could think of. Life force, Manitou, one of my favorite words. That's what some of the Native Americans call the ultimate reality. I think that the ancient Mayans called it the Chulel, Chulel. It was identified as something to do with your blood. That energy was in your blood. And it is true. And people who do hands-on healing, which is a technique we all can learn, I'm in the process of learning it actually, they, to enhance their healing process, and doing the hands-on healing, they will breathe deeply. They're taking in the prana, the energy, from the air all around them, and that, of course, goes right into their blood, and it then gives energy to their hands or whatever area of their body that the energy is focused into, mentally focused into, to let the amazing healing happen. Okay, so obviously the ancient Maya, just amazing. They were obviously smarter than our professionals who aren't even putting together everything I just said. They're not even aware of. I mean, you can read a book, Quantum Touch, by Richard Gordon. It'll teach you in Chapter 3 how to do quantum healing. Probably many of the listeners listening to me now have heard of that book. He's been on Coast to Coast AM. And it's, I mean, if we have that kind of power as humans, there's something huge going on in the world that we're oblivious to. It's not, I mean, we're basically watching television here as humanity. We're working at jobs we don't like. We're running around because we're too busy and don't have time to sit and focus and sit and meditate and think, focus on our families, ourselves. We're doing that, and we're watching television, and that's just simply not what humans... A huge, massive brain that you have above your shoulders is not meant to sit and watch TV. That's dumbing the brain down. It's taking its energy level and decreasing it. If you've ever studied somebody in a dream state, because you can, you know, hook up electrodes and whatnot to people when they're sleeping and measure different brain waves and brain states they have when they're sleeping, the energy is unbelievable. how much energy gets going in the brain state. You can do the same when a person is on sacred mushrooms. I should not say on. That sounds like it's a drug or something, which of course it's not. A drug is something like beer or nicotine. Notice I said the two legal ones, quote unquote legal. You can gain religious power from certain kinds of substances, such as Dhammayana is a kind of tea that you can drink, which helps with telementation, helps with religious meditation. Chocolate, I discussed this in my book, Telementation. If you go to the grocery store and drink and eat chocolate, like Hershey's, it's junk. You're getting a bunch of chemicals and sugar and artificial flavors. But if you go and eat, there's another kind of chocolate, a brand called Dagobah. I actually eat that because I like the name of the company, of the brand name of the chocolate, because of course Dagobah, that's where Yoda lived in the later versions of the Star Wars movies. But chocolate can give you, if you eat enough chocolate, you kind of become high. Again, that's probably a poor word choice, because people associate that with people doing cocaine or something. Let me just say you can have a certain kind of ecstasy, let's put it that way, a light, mild euphoria, a sort of religious, well, I don't want to say religious, well, maybe I do, a religious high. I want to say religious because you can use that to become, you can use that in your meditation. It makes meditation go easier. It makes telementation work better. And it's amazing there's a substance out there named chocolate. You can go buy it at your natural market, at your organic food store, which can make your meditation literally increase in its productivity by 100 times. It's so unbelievable. So, anyways, we were talking about brain states exploding in dream states and also in religious, with meditation and psychedelic substance experience, shamanic experiences, brain activity absolutely explodes. And you can measure someone, they're watching TV, they're basically dead, to put it curtly, compared to, the brain is meant for some sort of greatness. Think if we could measure with electrodes and instrumentation, the brain state of St. Paul. Was it the road to Damascus that he was on? When he saw the light of God and it struck him down and he basically passed out on the trail because of this incredible mystical experience, this direct experience of the ultimate source of reality. Think if we could measure his brain. Do you think it would look like the brain scan or the brain measurement, brain activity of the person sitting there watching TV with drooling, eating a hot dog? I don't think so. I think it would be one person would look dead, and the other person would look like they're on fire, like they're exploding. Okay, so that tells us that we've got this thing, this receptacle. And now, look, it's called the brain. Now, let me just keep in mind, the brain is not in your head only. The brain, as we talked about last week, is your whole body. And those nerves, your brain is made of neurons, and there are neurons that are in your hands. They're called nerves. We've all heard of that. They're in your heart, and your heart has dopamine. What's dopamine doing in your heart? Lots of it, too. Is your heart thinking? We talked about that last week as well. But anyway, so anyway, your brain, to think that your brain is where you are solely is a mistake. Your body is where this force of consciousness is swimming around. Your whole body is. So, but anyways, we humans are not made for the way we're living our lives now. Starting wars, eating hot dogs, watching TV, bickering about who's going to should win American Idol or whatever. I've actually never seen American Idol. I'm happy to say. So what we are made for is that we have a huge brain tells us that we're made for something great. And what is great is religious experience, because our brains are most active in those sorts of states. Now, of course, they're very active when we're doing mathematical calculations, when we're doing scientific work. Of course, our brains are very active, but not as active as they are in the religious ecstasy, in the religious trance. That's when we are true humans. That's when we are being what we are made to be. So what is it that creates? Where did we come from? I want to go, okay, the last 10 minutes here, I want to get into that. That's where I've been wanting to go for the last 2 weeks. And so let's start talking about that just a little bit here. There are three, so we wonder, who are we? Where did we come from? You know, clear your mind. Get rid of this monkey theory. You're conditioned to think that you're just insignificant. You're just a dumb animal. Get that out of your mind because there's no evidence for that theory. Okay? Just put in your mind this thought right now. I don't know where I come from. I don't know what my origins are. I don't know exactly what a human is. Okay, and how does it feel? How does it feel to all of you when you put that in your mind? I bet some of you out there are just feeling an explosion of energy inside of you. Because that's called freedom, that energy that you're feeling. Okay? That's called that's called deprogramming, breaking out of incorrect paradigms. Okay? So, that's called a great mystery. The mystery is where the knowledge comes from. Now notice that's a paradox. That's very Taoist, what I just said. You know, Taoism always ties contradictions. In mystery, you will find truth. You know, mystery is supposed to be an unknown. When I'm saying in mystery, you find truth. That's exactly where we're going here. So anyways, let's get back to, I want to talk about human origins a little bit now, and we'll probably just barely get into it. I really want to go into it next week. So let me just get right into it before I get sidetracked on some interesting issue. All the world religions are concerned with, let me back up a little bit more. There's three major theories I know of for where humans come from. One is evolution. We come from chimpanzees. Two, a Christian idea. We come from a single God created us. And then three is we come from extraterrestrials. Extraterrestrials created us. Okay. Actually, two and three, the Christian idea, the idea of a single God creating us and extraterrestrials creating us, those are actually the same theory. Okay. Think about it. What is God in a Christian scenario? Think about Jesus. Somebody who comes, Jesus is supposed to be God. Apparently, some people disagree with that the Bible doesn't really say that, but it does kind of seem to be in there, like John 10:30 says the Father and I are one. I know some people disagree. I think maybe that doesn't, I don't know. Anyway, let's just leave that on the shelf for a moment. If Jesus is God or God's messenger, then you have the force of God coming to earth as a creator. Okay, and then also before that, in the Garden of Eden, God comes to earth, finds primeval humans, or finds dirt and whatnot, and creates humans out of this material, primeval humans out of this. Now that's a super powerful entity coming from without to the earth to create humans and then leaving again. Identical to this story, what I'm about to say to you now. An extraterrestrial with superpowers comes to Earth, creates humans, and leaves. Okay, those are the same stories. Okay, there's idiosyncrasies to each of them. There's variations, but roughly it's the same theory. So we're going to reduce this down to two theories. There's the theory that there are religious super creatures, star creatures you could call them, that's my favorite term for them, who create humans. And have sometime in our past. And then there's evolutionary theory. Now there's also possibly another theory where you could mix the two together. You could say, well, humans were kind of evolving from chimpanzees and then the star creatures intervened with, human evolution and sort of accelerated us and genetically modified us and so forth. Now some of you out there may not think that, how could they genetically modify us? They didn't have the technology. If you think that, you are being controlled by the non-evidential, unscientific theories that you have been given, where humans started off primitive and got more and more advanced, and they're at their most advanced point now. Okay, and again, just to repeat, I have to repeat this because it's just so elementary and people are so unfamiliar with this. the evidence does not point towards that kind of development. We became more and more advanced till now. Just simply look at the archaeological record of human activity, human development, and you will find out that it's not at all the case. We were more advanced in the past, much more advanced. Okay, we can't build the things that our ancestors built. The Dark Ages, we descended into the lowest point in known human history then. Okay, if we're at a linear... Okay, so anyway, I went over this before. So let's get back to these human origins theories. It would appear to me... I'm not sure if there's only two theories. There's got to be another theory out there. For all practical purposes, those are the two theories that dominate the world. I mean, any world religion that I can think of, anywhere that I know of, follows basically the exact same theory, just religious story. All of them say that light creatures or star creatures or something came from the sky or something or some other realm, created humans. Some of the religions say they taught us how to do things like plant, and they maybe gave us wheat or hemp or something, and then they left. Why would every single religion on planet Earth say that? That is utterly stunning. And it's completely ignored by the academics. It just makes me think the academics just should be ignored. Of course, I don't want to really say that because we don't want to. I mean, we can take into anything anybody has to say, of course. But that's pretty shocking, pretty pathetic. So, anyways, the other theory we've talked about is being evolution. So if there was only two theories, only two options. Now again, I'm not saying that's. I think there might be some other options out there, but pretend for a moment that those are the only two options. If evolution from chimpanzees has no evidence for it, as we've discussed two shows now, then that means that the other theory is right. Okay, that's point one. Point two, if the other theory, the theory that we are created by star creatures, is correct, then that would mean that there's evidence for that all over the place, and we should be able to find this evidence. And an actual science, not fake science, should be able to, you know, give us all kinds of dissertations and treatises on the evidence involved in the science. And sure enough, the evidence for this theory is absolutely everywhere. Okay? I'm just sitting here almost speechless and dumbfounded. Just so shocking that, I mean, how can all the academics, so we got theory one and theory two. Theory one, evolution from chimps. Theory two, star creatures created us. There's no evidence for theory one. There's masses of evidence for theory two. How can it be that all the academics focus on theory one? Something funny is going on there. They're being manipulated by big money or something. Or it's just really amazing. I mean, why can you find virtually no academics that if they even talk about theory two, they get fired from their jobs. I think it's Michael Behe at Lehigh University. He's a Christian. Of course, he follows theory two. His star creature there, of course, is God, the Christian God. I don't know if he got fired or was threatened to be fired and so forth, just because he simply has questioned Darwinian natural selection. I mean, it's pretty amazing. So anyway, I want to thank everybody for watching this show. Listening to this show. I'm getting a little tired here. We'll continue this next week, and we'll explore everything. You can email, if any of you want topics you want to discuss, please email me. And thank you for the emails that all of you sent to me. And don't forget to check out my website, antimatterradio.com. And I'll look forward to continuing this and any other topics you want to go over. Next week, and we'll get this show to be a blast of the right information. Thank you.
you going from doctor to doctor?